Heather McGee is a commentator. She's also a strategist, so you've probably seen her on news programs talking about economic and public policies. And one of the things she's noticed in her work is that over the years, as a country, we have drastically underinvested in what she calls our public goods. Stuff like roads and schools, but also parks and community centers. She says we invest less per capita than almost every other advanced country. And you want to know why? McGee says you won't find the answer if you apply a basic economic principle. She's tried that. But voters and political leaders, she says, they don't just act on basic self-interest. They act on a worldview. So the reason we don't have nice things, as she puts it in a new book, is because white people see success as a zero-sum game. In other words, they see the well-being of people of color as a threat to their own. What she's saying is that racism can destroy a public good and the public will to support that good. The perfect example of that is public pools.
In the 1930s and 40s, the United States went on a building boom of public amenities, public parks, public libraries, and public pools. They were not just any kind of pool, though. They were these grand resort-style public pools that could hold thousands of swimmers at a time. And they graced the American landscape across the country as a sort of glittering example of this overall ethos that the American government's duty was to help lift and lift the American standard of living to create the American dream. Yet, so many of these public swimming pools, though paid by everybody's tax dollars, were segregated for whites only, and not just in the Jim Crow segregated South, either by official ordinance or by custom, often enforced by intimidation and violence. The idea of publicly swimming together was a bridge too far for many white Americans at the time. In the 1950s, we began to see cases where Black children were drowning because they were unable to swim in the public pools in Baltimore, Maryland. A little boy named Tommy Cummings wanted to swim with his three friends, one also Black, as he was, and two white, and there was no pool where they could swim together. So they were swimming in the Patapsco River, and Tommy lost his life. He was actually one of three Black children to die that summer in Baltimore due to segregated swimming. And so the NAACP sued the city to try to integrate the public pools. What ended up happening in Baltimore, as well as in many towns across the country, is that this effort to integrate our public pools ended in a loss for everyone. I traveled to Montgomery, Alabama, where Oak Park is the central park of the city. And I walked the grounds of what used to be a grand 1,000-plus swimmer pool in the center of the park. But effective January 1st, 1959, when faced with a court order that would integrate its segregated Oak Park pool, the city of Montgomery voted to drain it instead. It drained the water, backed up trucks of dirt, seeded it over with grass. Not only did it drain the public swimming pool in Oak Park, it also closed the entire park, sold off the animals in the zoo, closed the entire Montgomery Parks and Recreation Department, and kept it closed for a decade to avoid integration. When I went in 2017 to walk the grounds, there was just a flat expanse rimmed with these old oak trees. I actually bent down and picked up an acorn from the grass and put it in my pocket just to remember how recent it all was and how, if we don't learn the lessons of the past, they can take root again. I came across an elderly white couple that was sitting in their car as I was looking around for where the pool might have been. And I approached them to try to see if they would tell me, maybe if they remembered the pool themselves. They were not that welcoming to me. They didn't really want to talk to me. I asked them about the pool, and they said, of course they remembered. And they pointed right ahead, actually, to where their car was facing, and then quickly rolled up the window. There's no sign at the Oak Park in Montgomery to say that racism drained the pool. There's a plaque that does say that the park district was closed for 10 years, but it says due to a federal court order. There's no real public memory of the way that racism drained the pool and therefore had a cost for everyone.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Heather McGee is with us this hour, talking about her new book called The Sum of Us. The case she makes is that white people are damaged by racism too, though she does make it clear the ledger is nowhere near balanced. It costs people of color far more, of course. So not everyone is damaged in the same way, but the point she's making is that everyone does pay. She thinks about this stuff like a black person in this country, but also as the policy wonk that she is. She told us her interest in all of this came pretty early.
I was a kid growing up. I was born on the south side of Chicago in the era of, you know, massive economic dislocation, the Reagan social spending cuts, the beginning of the deindustrialization of cities. And so there was a lot that I saw and observed just as a kid driving around and being in that neighborhood. And I would always ask why. And thankfully, my mother was someone who worked in social policy and was, you know, always involved in the community. And so she had probably better answers for me than, you know, the average parent might. She sort of coached me to look at the structural and not just look at individual reasons for what was going on across our community. But I was just always drawn to the idea of trying to, you know, do the greatest possible good, to go upstream of the problems that we saw in our communities across the country and look at the ways that the decisions made by powerful people were making things harder or easier for everyday folks.
So you saw in that data, even then, there in that data, you would be able to find solutions to inequity and racism. You saw the geeking out part in all of that as part of a solution to a problem, I guess.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I was lucky enough when I was 22, I applied for an entry-level job at a think tank that had just started that advertised itself in the job description as wanting to tell a new story about poverty and opportunity in the country. And I still remember that today because it, you know, it really did feel to me like that was a big piece of what needed to happen. And then I got lost in the details because, I don't know, it's the way my brain works. I really loved the idea that you could design solutions to inequality, that you could sort of bring the data to the decision makers, offer them a range of options, and they could choose the best one to make life better for more people. That seemed to me like the way that government and democracy should work. And working at a think tank where I had all these tools at my disposal, as I worked my way up the ranks, I ultimately became president of the organization. We did a bunch of great things. We moved the needle. We had a few wins, but we had a whole lot of losses too. And it became clearer and clearer to me that there was something else going on than sort of cold, rational, economic policy decision making, and that I needed to learn more about what was really happening in this country to understand why we keep making bad decisions.
Yeah. You tell the story about how you were in this think tank fighting the good fight. You're having this, you know, meetings with, you know, Congress people and getting newspaper editorials written. You're feeling really good about it. They're, you know, making policy recommendations. And then you had this experience in Washington. You're presenting some research that you'd done to members of Congress. And then you're in the hallway of the Russell Senate office building. Mm-hmm. And you overhear something. Tell us a little bit about what you heard, because it, you say you, you left that day feeling, you said you felt stupid.
Yeah, this was the issue of debt, which was really the issue I worked on for the first half of my career. And in the economy, debt, credit card debt, people taking out payday loans, taking out loans against their houses, against their cars, had just exploded. Credit card debt, for example, had tripled over the course of the 1990s. And it was, you know, making money hand over fist for the credit card companies. And yet there was this one big problem in their profit machine, which was that people could file for bankruptcy and discharge their unsecured debts and get a fresh start. And we were bringing our research to show that that was happening more and more, not because people had suddenly just become worse with money or more irresponsible, but rather because the inequality was growing and the costs for the basics were totally outstripping stagnant and declining wages for working and middle-class people. So we came with that data and we were doing these lobby visits on the Hill. And it was during the time when the credit card industry's bill that they, their lobbyists had drafted to make it harder for people to file for bankruptcy was being debated. And I remember I was wearing these shoes. I was 25, right? So I had, that was like, you know, my like office shoes that I was wearing kind of for the first time for this lobby visits, you know? And they kept slipping off because they were ill-fitting. And I remember bending down to put my shoe on for the 30th time that day. And I heard this sort of barrel-chested, bombastic voice of a man going on about deadbeats who had babies with multiple women and then declared bankruptcy to dodge the child support. You know, the idea of government, you know, being used to escape personal responsibility. And nothing he said was about race, right? He did not explicitly say Black men who were having babies with multiple women. And yet the hair on the back of my neck stood up, right? My heart sped up. It was that kind of thing where you're like, I feel like there is an invective here that is not about people without money. It's about people without worth. And there's something else going on for this, you know, probably senator. And I honestly don't remember if it was a Democrat or Republican. I just sort of kept moving down the hallway quickly. But it was like, oh, this is about something else entirely. My charts that are showing, you know, what people are putting on these credit cards and why people are going into bankruptcy is not the story that this man is going to hear. The story that this man is going to hear is one about human value and worth and deservingness. And I've got nothing in my data is going to refute his beliefs about that. So it was just this idea, right? Like often it's very similar to the welfare reform debate, which had been so racialized, also about the deservingness of people with very little money. And it just felt like we were bringing the wrong tools to the debate and to the fight. And we were, you know, kind of getting beat as we did with the bankruptcy reform bill, which passed with bipartisan support and made it harder for people who had lost everything to ever have a fresh start.
So interesting because, you know, you were, you know, you're familiar with economic models and you say you realized that economics was an inadequate tool for explaining what was going on. That for explaining why people were voting for people like Donald Trump, for example, voting against their self-interest. And what you realized, I guess, is that people weren't operating in their own economic self-interest. As you said, something else was going on. There's something, I don't know, deeper or else happening here.
Yeah, it was, you know, we often use that phrase, are people voting against their self-interest, but they're defining their self-interest in a very different way.
Yeah.
And it's an interest that doesn't have to do with, you know, our standing in the world or the wisdom of the economic policies that are going to be promulgated under this administration. It's about whose side are you on? And it's about questions of status and belonging and inclusion and exclusion. And those questions have always in this country turned on race. And that's why about a year or so after Donald Trump took the White House, I decided to hand over the reins at Demos, at the think tank where I was president at the time, and go on this journey across the country to talk to experts, not in the issues that I had become expert in, but experts on public opinion and psychology and sociology and basically the whys of why people do what we do, why we are drawn to certain stories and explanations of the world around us, and why, in other words, we could continue to sort of sabotage our own well-being in so many ways. The question that set me off on my journey that begins the book is, why can't Americans seem to have nice things?
Right.
You know, and nice things is not like self-driving cars, which frankly, I don't think we need, but that's another topic. Yeah. You know, I mean, nice things like universal health care and a real public health system that could prevent this pandemic and contain it, and well-funded public infrastructure that could avoid what happened in Texas and avoid, you know, lead leaching into our pipes, you know, universal child care, paid family leave, the types of things that are the hallmarks of a decent standard of living that other countries with a fraction of our wealth and yet a more functioning politics are able to deliver for their people.
Heather McGee, her book is The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER would like to thank the listeners who support the public radio programs and news service that thousands of Utahns depend on every day. One way you can support our statewide service is by donating a vehicle. We accept cars, trucks, RVs, and more, whether they're working or not. And the process is easy, too. We'll take care of the towing, and we'll provide you with a donation receipt. You can learn more about donating a vehicle at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Heather McGee is with us talking about her new book, The Sum of Us, where she explains how racism has costs for everyone, white people too. She says the core dysfunction in our country, the thing that's holding back our investment in public goods and infrastructure, is racism. It's an idea, a narrative that white people see the well-being of people of color as a threat to their own. McGee says until we destroy this idea, it's going to block our efforts to create a community that benefits us all. So I wanted to talk about some of the people you talked to in this journey you went on, some of the studies that you write about, the people who are doing these studies. You say that laws are just an expression of a society's dominant beliefs. And you mentioned in the book there's this stubborn belief in this country that we're really going to need to figure out and shift if we're going to make any progress. So let's talk about what this belief is, because you found some clues in this series of psychology studies that you write about. And I wanted to ask you about one study in particular by these scholars at Harvard Business School, Michael Norton and Samuel Summers. Tell us about that.
So they are finding that this was Professors Norton and Summers, and the title of their study that they released was Whites See Race as a Zero-Sum Game That They Are Now Losing. And I went to go visit them in Boston and talk about what they had found. And basically what they had found was that the white folks in their study had, this was in the second term of the Obama administration, they rated anti-white bias as being stronger than anti-black bias. And they explained that it had sort of, it used to be the reverse, but around the 1970s, it became stronger, this anti-white bias, and that there was a zero sum, that progress for people of color, which they perceived to be happening, you know, at an alarming pace, was coming at the expense of white people.
They rated anti-bias as more prevalent in society than anti-black bias, which seems kind of laughable, but that's fascinating. But it's also fascinating that they found black people don't see it that way.
That's right. I'm black.
Yeah.
Don't see that our progress has to come at white folks' expense. And that zero-sum worldview is not something that is as common among people of color as it is among white people. And other studies that I then went on to read talk about how white people who are shown headlines about demographic change, who are politically unaffiliated, then after they're shown these headlines, right, that the, you know, it'll be majority minority country in 2050 or whatever, become more conservative in their policy preferences on things that are not necessarily or obviously related to race, things like drilling in the Arctic or healthcare or the minimum wage, right? There's this sort of sense of that they see the world through this lens of competition, and that being on top of a racial hierarchy has afforded them benefits. And if they are no longer on top of that racial hierarchy, that, you know, it's going to be bad for them. And so that actually changes the policy preferences. It became clear to me that this was really it, right? This zero sum was the big iceberg that was blocking, you know, the ship of state in the United States from being on the right path and from just progressing in so many ways. I mean, for me, the story of how it is that the majority of white Americans turn their back on the formula that helped create the white middle class is the mystery that I wanted to figure out. Yeah. Because that formula was one of high taxes, huge government spending, huge government protections in the market for small business and against antitrust and for consumer protection. It was a high unionization rates. It was, you know, the massive sort of New Deal expansion of government to ensure a higher quality of life. And that used to be enormously popular with white Americans. In fact, in 1956 and 1960, two-thirds of white Americans thought there ought to be a government guarantee of a job for everyone who wanted one. Yeah. and an income, a minimum income guarantee in the country. And that was in 56 and 60. And then when they asked the question again in 1964, the support among white Americans for those two economic guarantees had cratered in half to just 35%. And, you know, I had to look at the spreadsheet multiple times and say, what happened in between 60 and 64? And then it dawned on me, well, 1963, the March on Washington for jobs and freedom, which includes actually as the demands, one of the set of demands, two of the demands were for those economic guarantees, but it was by Black people demanding that level of investment in the American dream and that level of security. 1963, Kennedy's big media campaign around civil rights, firmly associating the government, the Democratic Party with civil rights, saying we are going to expand the notion of who's included in the American dream to include everyone who's fought for it and contributed to this nation's prosperity. And then, of course, we all know that Kennedy's successor, Lyndon Johnson, would be the last Democrat to win the majority of the white vote for president after he signed the Voting Rights and Civil Rights Acts. And that was really the beginning of the shift of the majority of white people away from, as I said, the formula that had created shared prosperity and towards more of a belief in the private marketplace, which is a very racialized understanding, right? As it was clear in the wake of integration that private could be segregated, right? In the private sphere, we could continue like segregation academies, like private swimming pools and membership-only swim clubs. We could continue to have the racial hierarchy. It was government that frankly used to be the enforcer of the racial hierarchy that suddenly was going to be the upender of it. And so white people turn their backs on government.
It's interesting in the book, you go way back to explore the history of this idea. Like, where does this come from, this idea? And it's an economic story, like how the country rose from, as you put it in the book, you know, a starving colony to a world superpower. And the answer is slavery. Or that's a big part of the answer for sure. And you write about in the early days of the colonies, you mentioned that there was this concept of race being formed. So take me through this, if you would, how influential Europeans started to create these, you describe them as taxonomies based on skin color and religion and culture. So talk about how this is starting to form.
So we take for granted the idea that slavery would be only for Black people, the idea that to be white in America would be attendant with all these privileges, and that people from all over Europe would be considered white. But all of that was not a given, you know, in the colonial period. And it really was about the economic model of stolen people and stolen land and stolen labor that needed a rationale, it needed a justification for a very Christian set of settler colonists, right? They needed to be able to say that what they were doing to indigenous people and Black people was somehow sanctified by the church. And that's when the church leaders in England and in the colonies really said, okay, we're going to get away with, we're going to do away with Imago Dei, the idea that all humans are in the image of God. We're going to create this taxonomy of humanity and say there are different races of being. And so if you were not a Christian and you were not of this new white race, then it's okay for us to do these inhumane and unimaginable things. And that was a justification. And then the question of how then we got this sort of zero sum, this idea that these different groups, you know, the white race was inclusive of all white skinned people and exclusive of Black and indigenous people, and that they were, you know, sort of intrinsically at odds, really was a set of decisions that happened. And the main impetus of them was to ensure a big enough us, a white us, that included not just the people setting the rules who had all the economic and political power, but also the masses of white landless people who came here, you know, from debtors' prisons and orphanages, and who came here with no land and very little education, but they needed them to be part of the us to, like, physically defend against slave rebellions. And that's really been what the zero-sum lie, the zero-sum story has done throughout our history, has offered white people just enough privileges to have them choose their race over their class and have them side with an economic elite that is, you know, today, particularly now that we see the draining of the public pools of resources, the sort of set of policies that really gutted the investments that made the middle class possible, we see that the benefits of that economic racial bargain are really lower and lower. And that's where I think there's an opportunity to rewrite the narrative and say that this drained public pool has nothing for most of us. And it's time to reinvest and refill the pool of public goods for all of us.
It's so interesting. You mentioned this zero sum was never solely a material thing. You think about that relationship as economic, but you say it wasn't just about that. It wasn't just about cheap labor. You say it was also personal and it was also social too.
Yeah. You know, I think it's important to remember that as so many of the psychologists and sociologists that I talked to were very clear, is still operative today, that in a society that is so hierarchical, where, you know, there's this sort of clear ladder of status and security and wealth, and if you are on the bottom of that ladder, you know, life is hell, right? And there was sort of a very clear hell shown by the daily presence of rightsless people, of Black enslaved people to whom anybody could do anything, right? And so it made the value of being one rung above that bottom, all the better, right? And in fact, it meant psychologically that new immigrants who came could, you know, face a choice, right? You know, they were often working side by side with Black people and enslaved people, or just barely not enslaved people. And yet there was a choice. Do we, you know, join arms, link arms, and fight for better conditions for all of us? Or do I do everything I can to climb up the ladder and kick the bottom to make sure I'm far away from it?
Yeah.
Right. And so often the latter is what happened. It's this thing called last place aversion. In a strictly hierarchical society, you would rather be anything but last place, right? And the lengths you would go to not be at the very bottom. And that's where we get the anti-Blackness in our society. That's really about a sense of personal worth. And it helps to explain some of the sort of distortions in our politics and in the behavior. The rationale to drain the pool, the lengths white parents will go to avoid sending their kids to school with too many Black children.
You know, you mentioned, as you said, that racial hierarchy gave white people a reprieve from the class hierarchy. And this was particularly sad that you write about in the book, that white women in slaveholding communities, they considered their slaves their freedom. Like, this was an escape from gender oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I have to say, particularly sad, this fact.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's an amazing book by Stephanie E. Rogers Jones that talks about this, called They Were Her Property, where she's an historian and she goes back and she sees just the degree to which so many of the slave contracts were held by white women at a time when white women, you know, were not necessarily allowed to own their own property and have their assets and debts free from their husbands and all of that, right? It was a very clear patriarchy and even more so in the South culturally. And yet having enslaved people gave white women, you know, freedom from so much of the drudgery of being a woman. And I tell these stories at the beginning of the book, in the first chapter, where I go and look back at where the zero-sum racial hierarchy came from, to ground us in the idea and the truth that racism, it hits its target first and worst. My book is about the cost of racism to everyone, but I want to be clear that, you know, there is no comparison. The ledger of harms is nowhere near balanced.
Yeah.
And yet it is a lie to suggest that the harms can be fully contained. And it helps us understand what happened to the American dream. Who killed it? And why did so many people who had been the beneficiaries of it cheer its demise? Why is it that we have a society that is so singularly stingy to itself, where we invest less per capita in public goods and in our common needs than virtually all the other OECD countries? And we're around Latvia and Estonia. No disrespect to Latvia and Estonia, but I would like to think that the country, you know, that used to have infrastructure that was the envy of the world could do better for its people. And yet this association, this degradation of the public, once the public became more diverse, has hamstrung our progress and has cost our economy dearly.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about, you tell the story about when you were in grade school during Black History Month, and there was this presentation, you know, lots of images of Dr. King and Rosa Parks and singing. And you mentioned how one girl in your class, Vanessa, 11 years old, she's white. She turned to you during one of these presentations and she said, "I wish I was Black." Talk a little bit about that, because you use this as an introduction to a section where you discuss the question of morality.
Wow. So, you know, this is something that I've thought for a long time. Maybe it was first crystallized for me in that when that happened. I really understood what she meant. I mean, what she meant was totally obvious. We had just finished watching a scene of From Eyes on the Prize. We had just sung the Black National Anthem, like the whole sort of morality of white versus black evil, yeah, right, had just been on display. And right, she's a kid. And so she's like, well, I don't want to be one of the bad guys. You know, I mean, that's like obvious, right?
Yeah.
And so I knew what she meant at the time. It didn't strike me as anything. I also knew that, you know, 23 other hours out of the day, she would not have said that. And she did not feel that way.
Right.
But, you know, there's this sense that actually in just this lane, in the lane of, if I'm really aware of, you know, the moral story of the United States, I, as a Black woman, have one privilege, which is that I was born among the heroes in that story of social progress, not among the villains, right? It's actually, we all like to see ourselves as on the side of the heroes. We don't want to be the villains. We don't want to be associated with the villains. We don't have to think, was that my father, you know, pouring the milkshake over the heads of the kids at the Greensboro Woolworth counter, right? Like, it's clear to me that that wasn't my father, right? I know what my father was doing during that time. And there's a sort of moral weight and a moral cost, which comes from being white and from not, you know, refusing not to see, you know, the true story of America's racial story. And it is a cost that white people bear and that those of us who've borne every other cost of racism simply don't have to bear. And I use that sort of inversion of how we normally think about, you know, the privilege, the moral privilege, to open up a conversation in this chapter called The Hidden Wound, which is the one chapter that's, you know, not about public policy as much. It's not about the economy. It's really about this question that I couldn't avoid writing about as I traveled the country, which was, you know, our economy is really guided by a set of beliefs and assumptions about what's right and what's fair and who belongs and who deserves. And that's about morality, right? So so is the fact that we have this sort of original distortion of white supremacy, which includes many morally inverting forces. And that's what has to happen, right? Just as we talked about how the church had to invert its own teaching to say that it was okay to enslave and dispossess and commit genocide and rape and torture and kill. This country, in little small ways, has had to do that kind of moral inversion in order to justify the racial hierarchy and the social order. And, you know, you see that in so many places where there's sort of a mental gymnastics that has to happen, that white people have to do in order to sort of be okay with where we are as a society.
I wanted to ask you about the hidden wound. It's something that you mention you got from the white farmer and poet Wendell Berry. Tell us about the experience of finding that book and reading it. You didn't really encounter it, I don't think, until like it was 2017. And then when you did, you just couldn't put it down.
Yeah, it's the book was given to me. I was in Kentucky in one of my many trips and conversations, talking to this lovely multiracial grassroots organizing group called Kentuckians for the Commonwealth. And one of the organizers gave me her dog-eared copy, and I went back to the hotel and I read it cover to cover. You know, Wendell Berry is a poet and activist and kind of philosopher, you know, amazing character.
He's pretty amazing, yes.
He's pretty amazing. Yeah. And he talks about the hidden wound as something that he's carried all his life. It's the moral wound that his complicity with white supremacy has created on his soul. I didn't set out by any means to write about this sort of aspect of it. And yet I couldn't avoid what, frankly, people kept telling me, you know, white folks that I was talking to across the country, was that there's something just deeply wrong about the way we are.
Well, not only that there's, you describe it as a psychological exertion, like this. It takes effort, and it somehow strips something out of you to be this way. That seems like what Barry was getting at as well.
Yeah. I mean, he was saying there's this cost. It's, he says that it is something that he knows on a very deep level that if he ever truly faced it, this wishful insinuation that we have done no harm, there's this anguish implicit in the racism. You know, it's really about when you awaken to it, you're subject to these, as he writes, these staggering recognitions of your complicity in history and in the events of your own life. And he says this wound is something he's borne all his life, always with the most delicate consideration for the pain I would feel if I were somehow forced to acknowledge it.
Yeah. And James Baldwin, right around that time, is when Barry wrote that, he was writing a similar sort of idea. And you quote him in the book. He wrote that white Americans are, this is how Baldwin put it, dimly or vividly aware that the history others have fed themselves is mainly a lie. But he said they do not know how to release themselves from it. Mm-hmm. And so they suffer. They don't know how to get out of it, I guess, is what he's saying.
Well, that is where I feel like we as a society have failed ourselves, right? And where white leaders have failed white Americans, in that this is not an individual story. The story of racial trauma in the United States, right? This is not something I would love for people to buy my book and read it, but that is not the answer, right? It's not something that we can do in this sort of individual shopping cart Americanized way, where it's like, if I, you know, spend enough money educating myself or go to enough workshops or watch enough documentaries, I will fix what's wrong with America's racial wound. And the only reason why there's this pent up need to do that in this country right now, which I'm applauding, is because we've had no guidance, right? Other countries that have had the degree of racial trauma and the extent of the racial ordering in our society have had a national effort to do something about it. And they've recognized that there has to be a truth-telling, a coming together, and a repair. And we have not done that, not just for the benefit of the people harmed, but for the benefit of the society, to be able to say we have fully accounted for our harms and can move forward. And today in America, you know, you've got a Southern Poverty Law Center report showed that 8% of high school seniors can name that slavery was a primary cause of the Civil War. I think it comes down to this zero sum, right? This idea that if we were to tell the truth, it would mean that white people would lose out, right? They know what it means to be a minority in America and they want nothing to do with it, right? And I can't say enough that so much of the behavior, the oppression has come from being raised as white Americans have been and as America has been with that zero sum lie. And that is not actually a belief, a story that has been useful to Black and Brown America. And so we have not bought it, right? I mean, we have not, there are differences in the stories that are kind of most often accepted by different communities in this country. It's because of, you know, what powerful elites sell to different communities and for their own profit. And it's because of what we buy because it's useful to us.
So you mentioned this national process that we don't have or haven't really had a truth and reconciliation sort of process. But you do write about a process, I think this was in 2017, where these 14 communities around the country came together and they called that process Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation. So there is some work, it seems to be, going on. Do you feel like that this is – we're ready for this sort of a process nationally to have this kind of conversation and really ask those difficult questions?
Well, to be clear, we have to, right? There's just no other way. We can't keep going on like this. And because, however, you know, one part of our politics has really learned that if they're not going to change their vision and their message and what they believe and stand for and offer to American voters, that this kind of white identity politics and the shrinking of the electorate and the sort of naked power grab is the only way they can maintain power. So the stakes have become much higher for the selling of the zero-sum story, right? You saw the American Rescue Plan pass, which has a benefit for every single American. And yet, what did Fox News cover was black farmers. What did the senators who voted against helping their constituents do? They, you know, fled to the border to talk about immigrants overrunning the country. So the zero sum is even more valuable right now to the political and economic elite on the right. And yet it is a lie and it cannot stand. And it is going to continue to cost us in our country's standing, in our country's ability to deal with big problems like climate change and inequality. And so I do think it's necessary. There is a bill in the House and in the Senate to institute a national truth, racial healing and transformation process. But the thing that is compelling to me about that particular framework is that it is a grassroots bottom up process, and that it does allow community members to come together to heal, to rewrite the community history of their where they live, to set a new community vision that rejects a sense of a hierarchy of human value. It's happening all over the country. And in the book, I talk about what's happening in Dallas. But we've got to come together in multiracial groups and face the truth, reject the zero sum, recognize that, yes, racism hits its target first and worst. And yet there is a cost for everyone. And that what we have never truly in a sustained way experienced in this country is available to us for the taking. And that is the kind of society where we do get to swim together, and that where the American dream is totally available to all of us. And it's not a zero sum. And we do actually recognize that diversity is our superpower, and that this country is more than the sum of its parts. And that's why I wrote the book, to try to be an invitation into that future, which I think is coming, but we got to speed it along.
You dedicate the book to your mother. She's an expert in public health, as you were mentioning before. And you talk about this conversation you had with her when your journey was over, basically. You went to her home outside of Washington, D.C. It's a pretty hopeful end, I have to say, for the book. She's like, we're still young as a country. We're creative people. There's a way for us dealing with this old model. She seems hopeful, and it sounds like you maybe do too.
Yeah, I do believe that. You know, a woman who was born, you know, in Jim Crow America has seen so much change and is also smart enough and attuned enough to our challenges to not be fooled that they are kind of inveterate parts of our society. She knows that there are forces that are trying to sell us these lies and keep us apart. And that's what knowing our history and understanding the themes and the recurring instances in our history helps empower us to do, is to spot them when they happen again, to avoid being tricked by them in the present, and to write a different future. I think, you know, we've been robbed of our history when we are so illiterate about the way that racism held the pen when so many of our laws were written, and how that is the reason why this country is less than it should be, is the reason why we are so, why we can't seem to have nice things. and we deserve them. Every human being deserves the kind of economic security and freedom that should be our birthright for all the sacrifice that we have all made in service of its prosperity.
Heather McGee, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Heather McGee. Her book is The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.